It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This past weekend, Allegheny County Democrats gathered in what was described as a carnival-like atmosphere to cast their votes to decide which candidates the party should endorse in the upcoming May primary election. To be sure, the party gets some important work done during this annual event, but the party also parties. It's traditional big city politics in all its glory. But how much do the endorsements really matter? And is the whole process outdated in this modern digital age? I'm joined now in Studio A by Post-Gazette politics editor Jim O'Toole. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh, Jim.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Explain the significance of this event, the Allegheny County Democratic Committee's annual election endorsements.
Well, it's hard to answer that with a lot of precision. Like a lot of institutions in our society, the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party regulars have less influence than they once did, but they still have some impact, particularly at sort of low information elections, judicial elections. People go into the ballot box and they really don't know a great deal about the candidates. They're more likely to be, if they are Democrats, swayed by the name that they see on that slate card. For higher profile races, mayor, senator, governor, I think it's fair to say that they have less impact because people have so many more sources of information about those races, and they make up their own minds to a greater extent.
And the sources, the additional sources of information that people have being modern technology, they can go online, they can Google somebody, look somebody up, and check out their entire profile, right?
Sure. And then there's, of course, advertising and other traditional sources of information like that.
So an event like this, who does it draw?
Well, it draws the people who are members of the Democratic Committee. They're elected officials at a very grassroots level. They're elected by members of the Democratic Party in primary elections, and they're elected from each voting district in the county, a man and a woman from each district.
And how does the process work?
They come in and they make their way down a gauntlet of candidates and candidates' champions and cheerleaders, and then they actually vote with a paper ballot. It's an extremely low-tech affair. It takes about 2 hours then to count the ballots afterwards, which gives lots of time for rumor-mongering and suspicion casting and so on and so forth.
Right, and we'll get into some of that as our conversation moves along here. But there are hundreds of people that vote in this, right?
Yeah, I think the number was a little north of 1,700 voted in the event on Sunday.
So these people that show up to cast ballots for a particular candidate to basically empower the people on the committee. They're empowering the people on the committee to act on their endorsement, on mm-hmm. their votes. So these people that show up to vote, I mean, are young people into this process at all, or is it an older demographic?
The party skews older than the population at large. I think that's fair to say.
So what happens when, as folks age, you know, are younger people into this process? I mean, years ago you would see, you know, people were excited about the vote. You had, decades ago, you had the push for the 18-year-old vote.
Younger people are not interested to the extent that older voters are in this process or in voting in general. If you look at the statistics for who shows up to vote, particularly in off-year elections, electorate skews much older. And you see that, and that has a lot of practical consequences. Programs for the elderly are a lot better funded than programs for, tuition assistance and so on and so forth. And if young people voted more heavily, politicians would respond to that input, but they don't.
So what does the party need to do? And, you know, this could apply, I'm asking about Democrats here, but it could apply to any political party, certainly Republicans or others. What does, in this case, the Allegheny County Democrats, what do they have to do to stay relevant?
Well, I think that they struggle with that question. I think that the difficulty that in that struggle is evidenced in, you know, outside forces. For instance, in the last two presidential races, the Obama administration or the Obama campaign team came up with OFA, Obama for America, Organizing for America, depending on what year it was. And that was a kind of parallel campaign organization. And OFA is most kind of celebrated for its high-tech aspects, the way its data mining, the way it harvested information from social media. But another big part of it, and this is very much relevant for an organization like the Democratic County Committee, was just people making contact with their neighbors, talking about their own choices on the theory that that's the information that people find most credible amid all the welter of advertising and other inputs that people are exposed to. But if you think about it, that is what the Democratic Committee is supposed to do. If they did that effectively, if they were reliably communicating with their neighbors, you wouldn't need a parallel organization like Organizing for America. So I think they are at a point where they have kind of a struggle for relevance.
We're talking with Pittsburgh Post-Gazette politics editor Jim O'Toole. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a comment or question, 412-246-2002. The number to call, that's 412-246-2002. What should the Allegheny County Democrats do to stay relevant, especially when they have a committee endorsement event and it's people in the older demographics that show up? What about young people? What happens in the future? How does the party stay relevant and vibrant? And it's certainly a question that could apply across the board to all political parties. 412-246-2002, our email address, essspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at essspgh. We have a comment from Jamie on Twitter who says, the endorsement process before the primary causes unnecessary rancor within the party and should end. He also asks, are there patronage jobs associated with these political endorsements?
Well, to take the first question, a lot of people, that's a point of view a lot of people have. The Republican Party doesn't bother to endorse at the local level the way the Democrats do. There's this feeling that it does, in fact, waste a lot of energy and money. And then, in fact, the party is not able to enforce its endorsement recommendations in any way. There's no there are no real penalties for backing a candidate other than the one that the majority of the committee endorsed. As for patronage, that still exists, but it's sort of at the margins. That is the caricature, and it's a caricature that still has some seeds of truth behind it. But in an age of civil service laws, and there just aren't that many patronage jobs. There isn't the kind of mass payroll or influence that once characterized local politics.
It used to be that there were all sorts of
patronage. I mean, the at the state level, at municipal levels, there would be a huge churn of jobs with the turn of each administration, and that's not the case anymore between unions and civil service laws.
Jamie, thank you for that comment. Describe, Jim, the carnival-like atmosphere. You know, we heard, unfortunately, I wasn't there, but you were, and those that were saw bagpipers, and there was food.
Oh, yeah, vendors. People in costumes, funny hats, people passing out all sorts of tokens, bingo daubers, a utensil I was not familiar with before I started covering politics. They're the things that are like big magic markers
sure.
that help you mark your bingo card. Emery boards, hats, T-shirts, all sorts of gewgaws to help you remember the different candidates. And it's a physically restricted area that the people go through, a long hallway to get to the point where they vote. And that has a carnival-like gauntlet atmosphere.
Yeah, I think I saw at Chelsea Wagner's table, a woman came by with a live animal. I'm trying to remember what it was. It was an exotic bird of some kind. And the endorsement everyone had their eyes on was the one for county controller the party regulars rebuffed the incumbent, Chelsea Wagner, and supported her challenger and predecessor, Mark Patrick Flaherty. What is the significance of this?
Well, this is part of a kind of a long-running soap opera in local politics. It was viewed very much as a proxy war between County Executive Rich Fitzgerald and Ms. Wagner. And those two have been feuding since they both took office 2 years ago. And Fitzgerald, Flaherty says he on his own missed the job that he relinquished when he decided to run against Fitzgerald and lost Fitzgerald 2 years ago. So he was inclined to run, and Fitzgerald was very much inclined to back anyone who would defeat Wagner, who's a great thorn in his side. And
right, they've clashed over finances and that kind of thing. She's called into question his keeping track of his expenses and whether he has been using vehicles for things other than county business and racking up the mileage, and he denies that, of course. And so therein lies the feud.
Yes, yes. And there are other issues going back to before actually either of them took office. There was a disagreement over whether a county tax increase was appropriate or not. She was against it, and he was not in a position to vote for it. He was out of office at the time, but he was happy to see it come into effect because he – in his view, the county needed it to stay solvent. And there are other things going on. I mean, there's some Hatfields and McCoys aspects to it. Fitzgerald very much was the champion of Bill Peduto's candidacy for mayor 2 years ago, whereas Ms. Wagner understandably was backing the candidacy of her uncle, Jack Wagner. She's a member of a prominent political family that's played a role in local politics for decades now. And it, interestingly, if she were to lose in the primary, and that's by no means a given despite the results of this endorsement vote, but still it's clear momentum for Mr. Flaherty, it would be the first time since the 80s, since I believe 1983, that no Wagner was in office in local office in this region.
So, you know, and Chelsea Wagner said about this that she's been battling the old boys club. Is that what is at work here? What about what she's saying?
Well, I mean, she's battling some old boys, but some other old boys are in her corner. So I don't think it was, although she is somewhat younger than Flaherty, I don't see that as a big generational fight. Ms. Wagner, I think she's 37. But she is very much steeped in the tradition of Democratic politics through her father, through her uncle. She is not was not perceived as an insurgent taking on the party from the outside.
And she questioned potential discrepancies in the initial vote tally. What about that?
Well, that didn't turn out to be as significant, and I think that she would say the same thing, as it at first appeared. There was some miscommunication. I don't know whose fault it was, but the subtotals for the city and the county got transposed in the reporting to her, and that on its face made it seem that there was something wrong with the results, that more people had voted in the city for Flaherty than actually voted in the city at all. But that wasn't the case. It was a miscommunication. There was one ballot box that she was interested in seeing it be re-canvassed, and when it was, she was satisfied with the accuracy. So it was one of those things that seemed like a good story at the time but turned out to be much ado about not too much.
And as you mentioned earlier, it's no secret that Chelsea Wagner's been at odds with the county executive, Rich Fitzgerald. So, you know, he endorsed her opponent in this race, Mark Patrick Flaherty. So how much credit does Rich Fitzgerald deserve for this outcome?
I think he deserves some, clearly. And he was very much invested in it. His close associates would tell you he was working the phones constantly. He was doing whatever he could to promote Flaherty's candidacy. And if you look at Flaherty's result in this contest compared to 2 years ago when he ran against Fitzgerald and just barely lost to Fitzgerald, clearly his support among the committee, it was a much stronger showing. And Fitzgerald, I think, fairly would take claim for some of that.
Even though not everyone he supported was successful in this case.
Right, yeah, right. There were some candidates he was championing in other races, county council races, that in three cases, and they are the only three that I know of where he had really taken a public position, his candidates all lost. So it's not as though this is the reincarnation of Dave Lawrence snapping his fingers and anointing candidates.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Post-Gazette politics editor Jim O'Toole. Let's go to Lynn in Highland Park. Lynn, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, I was wondering, I'd be interested in understanding the demographics of the nominating committee. In particular, what percentage are male, what percentage are female, what percentage are black, what percentage are white, what percentage are under 40, over 40, and what percentage are city residents versus county residents? And I'll take my answer off air. Thanks.
Thank you, Lynn. That's a great question.
Excellent question.
She's referring to the people on the committee empowered by their neighborhoods, the one or two representatives from each neighborhood who are on the committee who are empowered to cast the votes once all of the hundreds of ballots are tabulated by those taking part in this this get together. So what about those people?
Well, the first question is the easiest one, male, female. It's roughly 50-50 because there is a committee man and committee woman elected in each voting district. There's some attrition in the committee, and there are not strict gender rules on party officials like a ward. You can have a ward chairman and a ward vice chair and treasurer, and those skew the gender stuff a little bit. But generally, it's 50-50. City, county, it's about, this is very roughly, like 60% county, 50% city. There were about 650 votes cast, that's not precise, among committee members from the city. And there were about 900, a little north of 900 from the county. There's that discrepancy. Age, I can't give you precise figures, but as we discussed earlier, it does skew older. I think anybody who has the thinks about the last time they went to the to vote, you can see the people working the polls do tend to be older than the population at large. Black and white, I would guess that it would roughly mirror the composition of the city and the county, but I don't have specific numbers to demonstrate that.
In recent years, candidates not endorsed by the Allegheny County Democratic Committee have won elections, including Mayor Peduto, who did not seek the endorsement in 2013. So ultimately, how important are these endorsements in the modern digital age, especially when there are those who think that they should get rid of endorsements altogether? Mm-hmm. And the Republicans, as you pointed out, don't even do this.
Well, I would say less and less important, but at the same time, they can make a difference at the margin. We discussed earlier how kind of the low-profile races can be swayed by them, a judicial race, for example, compared to a high-profile race like mayor. But even in races like that, I can think of a few decades back, Tom Murphy was running against Bob O'Connor in the last for the last term in which Murphy was elected. And he was just barely won the endorsement over Mr. O'Connor. And Murphy was not a party regular guy. He was very much had an insurgent profile of his own, but his people would say that if O'Connor had had the imprimatur of the endorsement in that race, a race that turned out to be decided by just a few hundred votes, it might have been enough to put him over the top. I would say 4 years ago, when Fitzgerald barely beat Flaherty, who was I guess, considered a mild favorite going into the endorsement vote. That helped him in fundraising, things like that, because it did give him a mantle of credibility that people had sort of wondered about. He, unlike Flaherty, had never run countywide in the past. So I think waning influence, but not negligible influence. It does make a difference at the margin.
So the endorsement process, still relevant, still important. Should it in any way be changed? What do you
I mean,
what
I think
I'm
personally find fairly compelling the argument that it wastes a lot of energy, that people spend depending on the race, a fair amount of money and effort on this.
How much money are we talking?
Well, it depends on the race, you know.
Let's say since the big one this go round was the county controller, you know, how much would say a challenger who wants to, you know, who is going up against an incumbent like somebody like Mr. Flaherty, for example, how much?
Well, you need in the double digit thousands, and by the time you get to the primary, it gets to three figures, those are questions you can answer with more precision once the campaign finance reports come out just before the election. And the other thing is the psychic energy and the hard feelings that's engendered by that campaign. It can be engendered by those campaigns. And, are you not better off just to go to the primary and make your case to the electorate at large, the Democratic electorate at large, as opposed to the more rarefied electorate of the committee.
So even with the, there's sort of, this is supposed to be one of those fun things in politics, but if it's engendering some hard feelings, the gauntlet that you run, the people in the costumes, the food vendors, all the pomp and circumstances really is, it's something that only thinly covers the tensions underneath.
Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't, leave the listeners without the argument on the other side. When the endorsement, this process in its current mode came into being, it was considered a good government thing. The idea of giving the committee members a secret ballot was considered an advance, a reform over the prior system in which a very few members of the party hierarchy would just anoint candidates in a process that wasn't transparent at all. So the argument for it is that this is more democratic than just having a small coterie of party elders make the decision. It gives the committee members who are expected to work and communicate with their neighbors throughout the year some measure of power as a reward for their efforts.
Jan on Twitter asks, and we have just about a minute or less left here, Jim, but Jan asks, how can minorities break into the very closed circle of politics, of politicos, she says? How can minorities break into the very closed circle of politicos we have here in Allegheny County?
Well, I think the fundamental answer is to vote, to show up and make themselves a force at the ballot box, and giving the voter turnout numbers, percentages that we see in, demographic cohorts across the board. If one group can, as the elderly do now, can exercise disproportionate influence at the ballot box, the politicians are going to pay attention.
It all comes back to that, doesn't it? You have mm-hmm. to get out and vote. The president talked about it in his speech in Selma this
sure.
weekend, and you have echoed that message here. Jim O'Toole, who is the politics editor for the Post-Gazette, who covered this past weekend's Allegheny County Democratic Committee annual election endorsements. Jim, it's been a very enlightening conversation. Thanks for making time to be with us here in studio on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Coming up, addressing the challenges a child with disabilities or mental health issues faces transitioning to adulthood. We'll talk with State Rep Dan Miller, who's sponsoring a mental health summit. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A child with disabilities or mental health issues faces a number of challenges as they transition to adulthood. These concerns can include employment, health care, and independent living. The Disability and Mental Health Summit has been organized to help families address these concerns, and I'm joined now by the event's sponsor, State Representative Dan Miller. Representative Miller, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very glad to be back. Really appreciate the opportunity.
This is the second year for this event. Why is this fair needed?
Well, I'll tell you, there is a great need, and we're very glad to have it. And I want to say we have great partners who are helping us do it. But, you know, listen, often when it comes to finding resources that can help a family or an individual dealing with a disability or a mental health issue, you have to go through a lot of hoops and uncover the right person to talk to and different organizations to link together a system that can work for you. What this event here does is it really is a massive collection of resources. I believe the last count we had was over 115 participating organizations in one place at one time that people can spend their own time kind of strolling through, collecting resources and building their plan. So we do it here, meaning that sometimes there are some good events, very nice events in Penn State and certain other areas that people have to travel to and sometimes pay money and stay overnight. This brings it here, easy access for Allegheny County, and really there's nothing like it in the area.
And this is taking place. It starts tomorrow and continues through Thursday, correct?
Definitely. We're excited about this. We did do it last year, had great response. And through working with our planning committee and our hosts over at Bethel, we found that there were so many needs, so many questions, so many things to discuss that we expanded it to a second day. So this is our first time that we have 2 days. The Wednesday is a full day of program, both with our resource fair and with our workshops and seminars. And then the second day gives us an additional 4 hours of very interesting programming. We have a session with Congressman Murphy, who's coming in to talk of mental health. We have a great session teamed up with Mary Rob Jackson from KDKA, who's going to help us get an update on local stories that have been in the news with disability and mental health from Allegheny County families and individuals. And then we end on that day with a very special legislative panel with senators and reps from throughout Allegheny County, whether it's like Dom Costa's area or Senator Matt Smith. We have a great turnout that's coming for that. So that's the new angle for our programming.
And so what type of information are people going to get out of this?
Well, you know, what we tried to do is we wanted to give options and alternatives for people no matter where they are on the diagnosis spectrum, meaning that if you are brand new, whether it be your 2-year-old who's been diagnosed with autism, whether it's your 15-year-old who's been diagnosed with bipolar, or even as a young adult, we wanted to be sure that those who are dealing with the new reality of the diagnosis have resources. And likewise, those who are on the opposite side, those who have been 20 years of navigating through everything from early intervention through schools, and now are transitioning into young adulthood, which has its own sets of massive challenges. We wanted to be sure that we were appealing to both sets of the population, those sort of old and new in the diagnosis world. So we have put together a variety of programming that handles both. So you could go online to my website at pahouse.com/Miller.
And we'll put a link to that on our website at wesa.fm.
Thank you. And you could be able to click on whichever program that you want to attend. So whether you're new into the diagnosis world, you'll see your options. Or if you're into the young adulthood or the transition aspects, we are doing a special session with that too, with 21 Enable on the first night there. It's going to be a great evening program for those maybe who just got out of work. And you could click on which one you want to do. And if I could, there's actually one other exciting feature for how we've done these programs is we wanted to not only to appeal to those families and individuals who needed help, but also serve as a platform for communication and growth amongst professionals. So we actually have it that whether you are a teacher, an attorney, or a social worker, you can get continuing education credits by going to my website and clicking up and registering for this program. So we wanted to also appeal to that audience as well. Sometimes this arena, which is in dire need for real leadership and or a real state plan, just communicating and bringing people together, whether it be the individuals and families or whether it be the service providers or professionals in the arena, that actually is a big thing that we can do to help. So we're very excited to have both of that.
And are there particular issues being covered that that simply have not been addressed or addressed to the satisfaction of the people who need this information?
And, you know, I appreciate that question, and let me be clear with it. Anybody, in my opinion, who are dealing with disabilities and mental health cannot be satisfied by what we are seeing from our state and federal government now. You know, for example, once you are transitioning into young adulthood, there's a waiver system that's in place. The waiver system, you mentioned a variety of help that would come up, whether it be housing and different things. This waiver system, just to put it in perspective, has 4,000 Pennsylvanians right now on the emergency waiver waiting list to get help.
4,000?
4,000. Now, that's the emergency list. The next step down is 6,000 on the critical list. Now, I'm not quite sure what the difference is between emergency and critical, but that's 10,000 Pennsylvanians right now whose families are doing the best they can to try and increase their independence, increase their opportunity, and give them, help them enjoy life, but who are sitting there often with on a thin thread, often an aging family resource, an older parent, an older grandparent, even aunt and uncle, who are helping to provide that stability at home and are looking for more state assistance to be sure that that person has a place to stay. The waiver system is a massive problem we have now. We have a funding issue across the board that the ABLE Act, which is a federal legislation that Senator Casey helped with a big bipartisan majority.
We've talked about that here.
So that's another thing that we're trying to do. And real quick, even on the mental health side, we have a bill that right now that it's a mental health bed registry bill that makes it so that when you come to a hospital, for example, to seek help, you never get sent home because they can't find a bed. Half the time with it, they're looking for somebody to answer the phone to find a spot for you. And it could be, you know, in Lycoming County is where they're looking to try and find a spot. If nobody answers, that person is waiting for hours and hours, if not a day or two, at an emergency room. Often loses patients, time, and everything else. They go home until the next emergency comes up, and they get right back to where they were. So our mental health registry bill, bed registry bill, would look to put a real-time service so that you can go on a computer, find a spot, and get it done.
And we're talking with Representative Jim Miller about the mental health summit Representative Dan Miller about this mental health summit that's happening this week. And before I let you go, Representative Miller, why are the issues being addressed by the summit especially relevant to southwestern Pennsylvania?
You know, I believe that we have a lot of great organizations, a lot of great partners who are helping on this event, a lot of great school districts who are assisting. But linking up and getting on a singular page is a key component. So here in Western PA in particular with it, this is why I think this event is so special with it, is there's nothing that helps bring everybody to one table that is a uniting force for disability and mental health work. And this is why I think our event adds something special. You may occasionally find a very nice and a very good event here or there in the disability and mental health arena, but I guarantee you this, nothing in size and scope, nothing in discussion, nothing in the legislative arena will compare to what you will see on this Wednesday and this Thursday if people can make it to the event.
Representative Dan Miller joining us to talk about the Mental Health Summit he's sponsoring, taking place this week, the Disability and Mental Health Summit, that will link information. We'll have links to information about that on our website at WESA.FM. Representative Dan Miller, thanks again for being with us here on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we will talk about whether a college degree is diminishing in importance to students and their parents. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, one of the leading consumer trends for 2015 is something called Reject You. We'll find out what it is, but first. Each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
The English-speaking name for this place between the rivers, regardless of spelling, has always been an homage to the chief strategist of the French and Indian War, British Secretary of State William Pitt the Elder.
Pitt was responsible for the military strategy that was successful, and Forbes, in acknowledgement of that, named this place for William Pitt.
That's Louise Sturgis, Executive Director of Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation.
General John Forbes. He was a British soldier, and he was from Dunfermline, Scotland. And he would have had a Scottish accent. I can't say it properly, but he would have said Pittsburgh or something like that, like Edinburgh.
General Forbes' accent is lost to time. But in a letter to Pitt the Elder dated November 27, 1758, Forbes' secretary, the general was too ill to pen the note himself, gives his location as Pittsburgh, spelled P-I-T-T-S-B-O-U-R-G-H. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, burg, B-U-R-G-H, and burg, B-O-U-R-G-H, are variations on borough, B-O-R-O-U-G-H. But the O didn't stick. That the H remained is fairly impressive, says Scott Kiesling, Associate Professor of Linguistics at the University of Pittsburgh.
In the history of English, there are places where we used H for particular sounds that aren't there anymore, so it's kind of odd to have them.
Pittsburgh or Pittsburgh or something in between, P-I-T-T-S-B-U-R-G-H, was the predominant orthography throughout the 19th century, with one regrettable exception. When we filed for incorporation as a city in 1816, the printer left off the H. But hey, listen, spelling wasn't such a hard and fast thing in those days. That is, until the U.S. Board on Geographic Names came along in 1890.
We were doing a lot of exploration, and reports and maps were coming out with different names for the same features.
Lou Yost is the executive secretary for the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. It was created to standardize spellings nationwide in order to cut down on confusion.
And then in 1891, what the records show was the request of the Postal Service eliminated all places that ended in Berg. They dropped the H.
And why?
The reasoning that I've seen in the records is to save space.
More than a century's worth of use and we lose our identity to spatial budgeting?
Names get pretty emotional, and if you're on the side that the board rules against, you're usually not too happy.
Many of Pittsburgh's major institutions stubbornly held out. The Chamber of Commerce of the City of Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Steel Company, the Pittsburgh Stock Exchange, four newspapers, as well as all legal and municipal documents.
Names are important to people because it's about their identities, and it connects people with sort of their past and sense of being able to say who you are rather than somebody else telling you that.
The city's quiet resistance might have persisted indefinitely if it weren't for U.S. Senator and Allegheny County native George T. Oliver. He got the issue between his teeth in 1911 and called on the city's postmaster, William H. Davis, to establish the H's place in history and common usage. With a middle name beginning with H, perhaps Davis had a personal soft spot for the consonant. In a flurry of letters, Oliver pressed the board to reconsider its 1891 decision.
What's important to the board is local use or acceptance of the name.
Yielding to historical documentation and Oliver's personal appearance, the board reinstated Pittsburgh's H on July 19, 1911. Despite the victory, our consonant remains embattled. A 1994 map from Gambelli U.S. Incorporated, for instance, omits the final letter.
It sort of makes sense that we would start getting rid of it because it's kind of less and less useful in English. So pity the poor H.
Tuck it into your heart and promise to love and cherish the spelling of your city until bureaucracy do us part. For 90.5, WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh with its H. I'm Margaret J. Krause.
90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh is supported by UPMC. Ask your Pittsburgh history question and find more stories online at wesa.fm/inventingpittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. There's a continual emphasis on the importance of obtaining a college education. However, as the costs associated with higher education continue to increase, is a college degree diminishing in importance among not only college students but their parents? I'm joined now in Studio A by Vice President for Market Insights, Marty McGuff of Campos Research Strategy. Marty McGuff, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, thanks, Paul.
You're getting a lot of traffic on your website about Reject You. Explain this trend to our audience.
Oh, sure. I mean, every year we do 10 trends, but this one has got by far the most traffic. It kind of describes what I'd say is kind of the diminishing perceived value of a college education among consumers. And I mean parents that have to pay for it as well as students themselves. And what behavior is kind of happening as a result of it? And some of the things probably listeners are very common with: college debt. You know, there's so much college debt, poor job prospects. Parents are starting to question whether, you know, it's even worth it to pay all this money and put money away for a college fund.
Reasonable question to ask.
Yeah, it is. And universities haven't helped themselves in one way. They've tried to shift themselves more to careers rather than kind of higher learning. Just in 20 years, you don't see any, like, you know, classics programs, foreign languages, things like this. And you see, like, a, you know, more studies like public relations, communications, business, you know, things that are, like, really placing people into careers as opposed to higher learning. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing myself, but I'm saying that kind of also sets the stage that they care less about learning and more about jobs. And since it's so expensive to go to college now and they're not getting jobs, they're hurting themselves.
Yeah. You bring up a lot of interesting things to consider here. I'm thinking back to and you know, we can only draw on our personal experience
right. Sometimes
for a good example. When I went to college, I had a pretty good idea what I wanted to do, but I wasn't thinking so much about the job
right. As
much as the experience, and I wanted to learn things and be well-rounded and knowledgeable in a variety of fields. Mm-hmm. Are students still going into that with that idea nowadays, or has it become so costly that you have to come out of it with some kind of job that will enable you to pay off that loan or your parents or whatever, you know, whatever the debt is?
Yeah, I don't think kids, which would be my age, like entering now to college, and me were characteristically different as people. But I think that the pressures placed on them, the cost of college tuition, what's expected of them, a job market that's pretty bleak, and that they're going to be saddled with the student loan debt makes their emphasis right off the bat in freshman year thinking, when I graduate, what kind of job am I going to get? Will I be able to pay back my student loans? And they make a calculation in their mind whether university is really worth it from a financial perspective. And I think that maybe 10 or 20 years ago, that was less likely.
Is this the basis, though, from a philosophical standpoint, is this the basis upon which we should be deciding whether to go to college or telling our children, you know, you can go to college, but you better know what you want to do. You better have a job, you know, lined up
right. Soon
after you enroll.
Right.
And a plan and all this, as opposed to maybe this is where I mature as a person. This is where I gain knowledge and perspective.
Right.
And maybe I end up going in a completely different direction than I started in. Shouldn't that be what the college experience is all about?
Yeah, I mean, there's two schools of thought on that. I might lean to the first one you described, which is life learning, learn to write, learn to think, et cetera, like become a better person, be more ready for the world as it is, versus those that are going to be prepared actually for a job and to make money. But that's a hard sell for someone that comes from, you know, a lower or middle class income, that doesn't have a lot of money, that has to take out a lot of student loans to go where they're going. You know, that may sound all well and good, but it also places a lot of problems on them paying back the money. And if they come into a job market where they don't have a job right away, you know, they want you to pay your student loans within, you know, a year, 18 months. And that's very difficult for some people. So it is a balancing act. It's a difficult thing.
So what are local employers saying about this?
I mean,
I can tell you that many of them are saying for example, law firms are saying law schools are saying that students show up, young people show up, and they don't have the writing skills necessary for this profession.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to give kudos to the Carnegie Science Center. We did a study for them recently that enabled us to really talk to business leaders and educators and so forth. And kind of a universal thing coming back to us from these business leaders is that college graduates are not getting the skills they need to succeed in today's economy. And it's kind of framed this way. It's like collaborative, hands-on, problem-solving, project-based skills. You'll hear a lot about STEM education, you know, science, technology, sure, in high school as well as in college. And there seems to be a glut of that, that they're not getting the proper education to work right into the workforce. So
not getting the proper STEM education.
Yeah, they're probably not getting like – and it's not just math or science per se or physics. It's kind of the notion of like collaborative, hands-on, working with other students, learning problem-solving skills, working on projects. These are kind of skills that are emulated in the workforce that they would like to see colleges and universities in their curriculum offer more.
And how does it affect the Pittsburgh labor market?
Well, the Pittsburgh labor market is pretty interesting because it has two kind of growing sectors, what we would call kind of the advanced manufacturing sector. And, you know, with Marcellus Shale, we have like a large energy sector. And a lot of those jobs don't require a college degree. Like you could walk into an advanced manufacturing degree with a certificate program or, a community college degree and have a pretty decent job. You know, the whole idea of buying a house, buying a car, raising a family, the old notion of Pittsburgh, you know, pre-steel days. Same thing for energy. But they do have these jobs available that require some specialized skills that are possible to obtain without a college degree. And that's what's really causing a lot of, you know, interest among young people saying, well, if I can not go to a four-year degree and take the debt, perhaps I can study a certificate program, a community college program, get a job in these kinds of industries and still have a really decent, good life. And that's what's happening now.
We're talking with Marty McGough of Campos Research Strategy. He's Vice President for Market Insights. And so give us an idea of what the long-term impact of this trend will be on the marketplace.
Yeah, I think that you're going to find in some ways, in Pittsburgh as well as nationwide, like younger people are going to start to enter the market economy at a younger age. Whereas, you know, now we hear about 24 and 25-year-olds living with their parents, people getting the 5 or 6 year, 4 year, you know, BA. I think you're going to see people rejecting a university in some sense, getting a 2 year degree, getting a certificate program, and they're going to be entering the market at a younger age. So everything you hear about like millennials, they don't want to buy houses, they don't want to have kids. We're going to see a reversal of that trend where they're going to be in kind of occupations that pay them. They're going to be in the workforce, and younger people entering the market is going to be kind of an interesting phenomenon.
Hey, I had this friend from Pittsburgh, fellow Peabody graduate. He goes to San Francisco, the university or San Francisco State, studies filmmaking.
Right.
One of his professors tells him, you know, you're not a particularly good student. It's not your thing. So why don't you just go and start knocking on doors for jobs now? Because somebody will hire you to do something and you'll get a leg up on the kids who stick around to finish and get their degree who will be doing the same thing you're doing 3 years earlier. Is that kind of what's happening here?
That's a part of it, yes. I would say that that kind of viewpoint is becoming more prevalent, that parents are starting to think it, educators are becoming afraid of it, and the kids themselves are thinking maybe this is true.
Like, so
that's a mindset that is profoundly impacting this whole argument.
And we're down to like 10 seconds, but what can colleges do about it? What should they do?
They need to offer curriculum that teaches collaborative, hands-on, problem-solving, project-based skills.
There you go. In a nutshell. Marty McGough of Campos Research Strategy, our guest. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Paul.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, we'll talk about the controversial deer cull in Mount Lebanon. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.